We interrupt this program to give you a bulletin just received from one of our naval units at sea. A large object traveling at supersonic speed is headed over the North Atlantic toward the east coast of the United States.
This is H.B. Kaltenborn speaking. Here in the nation's capital, there is anxiety and concern, but no outward sign of panic.
And good evening. My name is Don Ecker. The show is UFOs Tonight. And tonight's show, we're going to be talking with one of the, I think, most delightful people that I have met in the last few years, and somebody that has been working ceaselessly and tirelessly trying to get NASA and keep NASA honest in reference to the Mars Observer and all the attendant phenomenon associated with the planet Mars. Is there, in fact, an ancient city just waiting to be discovered there? Well, the fellow that wrote The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, Richard Hoagland, is joining us tonight from way back on the East Coast. And for all you folks that live around the country, and for all you folks that are in Southern California, I'm going to give you some phone numbers where you can call in during the course of the program to speak to my guest this evening, Richard Hoagland, or myself. However, before I go to my guest this evening, Richard Hoagland, and before we start tonight's program off, I want to bring to you a little news update that I just personally broke nationally on computer systems around the country yesterday. It's going to be the featured news item in the new issue of UFO Magazine, which is going to be going to press the end of this week. And the individual in question is going to be my guest on this program 1 week from tonight. And who am I speaking about? None other than Dr. Bruce Maccabee, who is the Mutual UFO Network State Director for the state of Maryland. Dr. Maccabee is a naval optical physicist. He's been very prominent for just about 20 years in UFO research. And what's all the news about? Well, this week I had an exclusive interview with Dr. Maccabee, and as it turns out, for approximately the last 14 years, Dr. Maccabee has been briefing and going back to the Central Intelligence Agency in Langley, Virginia, and briefing them on UFO matters, UFO information, and in some cases, UFO personalities, and just generally telling them what's been going on in the UFO field. What does that mean? Well, depending upon your point of view, it would certainly seem to show that regardless of how many times our government denies it, there is without a doubt a definitive interest in the people that are following the field of UFO research. One night from tonight. Now, however, let's go to my guest, Richard Hoagland, who is back on the East Coast. Richard, it's a pleasure having you here this evening.
Good evening, Don.
And I guess in just about 3 weeks, a little over 3 weeks, something, as a matter of fact, the last time you were on this show this past year was right about the time that the Mars Observer lifted off. And
good grief, has it been that long?
It's been that long. It's been, I guess, September of last year, Dick.
Good heavens. How time flies when you're not having fun.
Dick, it's going to be, I guess, still a tough uphill fight.
You know, I really cannot believe, Don, that 10 years ago I was dumb enough to get myself into this.
Well, you were one of the people that started to ask questions about those unusual surface features.
Oh, if I had ever in my wildest dreams or nightmares imagined that it would take us 10 years to get even to the point where possibly we're going to get to see the pictures that finally put the mystery to rest. I really wonder, and I'm saying this with, a lot of feeling behind it, I really wonder whether I would have had the stamina to even begin this journey, because it's been one hell of a sleigh ride.
Well, Dick, for those people that may not be familiar with your work.
Oh, and, no. And not one more time.
One more time. For those folks that may not be or that just found out about us and tuned in since you've been on last time, how about a very brief overview of what this entire situation is, starting from the Viking mission?
Well, a funny thing happened 17 years ago.
On the way to Mars?
This July, on the way to Mars. In 1976, which was the Viking summer, as we call it, and it was also the 200th anniversary of this extraordinary experiment called the United States of America. This nation literally did what no other system on the face of the Earth had done, reached out to Mars, set down two robotic landers to finally search for life on the planet Mars. And I and about 1,000 other people spent an extraordinary summer traipsing from Earth to Mars every day at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is just north of you or south of you or east of you there in Pasadena, California.
Right, just a stone's throw.
And I was staying with Eric Burgess, who was a dear friend of mine and was the co-founder many years ago, along with Arthur Clarke and others, of the famed British Interplanetary Society. So I had the remarkable experience of spending afternoons and evenings with Eric and his wife, Billy, his lovely wife, Billy. And then in the morning, we would get into his little runabout, and we would come up through the back canyon there from Rock Ridge over to Pasadena, and we would spend our day on Mars. And this was a ritual that we followed for months that summer, because every morning the scientists at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory would convene a press conference at around 10 o'clock in the morning.
And all this information was still streaming back
to
Mars.
Tons of data, thousands, millions of megabits coming back.
And it was available in real time. You could see it as soon as it came in. Is that correct?
You could watch photographs from the orbiters as they went around the planet, and the data was dumped from the tape recorders across space to the Deep Space Network at Goldstone and Madrid and other places, Canberra. You could see these pictures literally frame by frame by frame. I mean, there were so many pictures of Mars, we were drowning in pictures of Mars. We were inundated in soil analysis, in chemistry, in polar cap deposits, in global meteorology. I remember that one television station in Los Angeles with a very flamboyant meteorologist named George Fishback or Fishbine. Do you remember the name?
No.
Anyway,
no, that was before my time.
He did Martian weather reports and Martian weather forecasts based on the meteorology data coming back from the landers on the Martian surface. It was an incredible dog and pony show. It was the catharsis and the pinnacle of our technological achievement of reaching out from Earth to another planet, ripping the veil aside, showing the world live and in real time on global television, which even in those days there was the beginnings of global television in terms of videotapes sent across oceans by airplanes and stuff like that. So eventually all of the world could see what the scientists at JPL could see as they were seeing it, and for a very, very privileged few, those of us who somehow managed to get inside those doors, we were on the edge of history in the making as it was being made, as the human species explored with the surrogate robot, our own, you know, surrogate of ourselves, what there was on the planet right next door. If you contrast that, which I have done now in my mind many, many times, anticipating the events that are going to begin about 3 weeks from tonight, if you contrast that with the way NASA currently is treating the Mars Observer mission, where there is going to be no live television, where one scientist basically has total lock on the camera data, where his laboratory has been set up not where all of us can gather and see it and joke with each other and look at the pictures and comment and say, do you see this and what is over there, but is hundreds of miles away down in San Diego where nobody is going to be able to get to. If you contrast the strange, churlish attitude of the project regarding our independent investigation and the feeling being projected that we're outsiders and interlopers and we have no right to even look at the pictures, let alone demand to see them in real time, there is this stunning contrast between our open naivete regarding the Viking mission in that splendid summer of 1976 and a very curious, confused, and contradictory, and very close now to outright dissembling NASA on this subject as we approach the fall of 1993.
Okay, Dick, we're going to have to take a very quick break. We've got to run an ad. As soon as we come back, I want to talk about what we hope to see and what all the hoopla is about. So, for all you cable subscribers that are out there, my guest this evening is Richard Hoagland, author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever. We are talking about the Mars Observer craft, which in just about 3 weeks will once again obtain orbit around Mars, and we hope to find out what's there. Are there problems? You bet. And that's what we're going to be talking about tonight. But first, let me tell you about... Dick, we are back. Now, one of the things that we're hoping to finally answer the question once and for all, is there a face in Cydonia? Is there an ancient city? Are there pyramids there? What seems to be the holdup? Why doesn't anybody want to talk about this? Why don't they want this out in real time? What do you think about that?
Well, of course, in 76, in that incredible summer, as part of this amazing database that was flowing back like in Niagara, one scientist described the Viking data flood as like trying to drink from a fire hose, which is a pretty good model.
Too much, you just can't handle it.
Of course, and no one could comprehend everything that was coming in. It was file on magnetic tape, it was accessioned, it was cataloged, it was archived, but the analysis that could proceed even in those early days and weeks was nothing compared to the depth of the data, which was literally piling up around our ears. And that has been a very sad shortcoming of the NASA process going back 30 years, Don, that we have always, through the Congress, appropriated far more money to do missions than money to analyze the data from missions in the years that followed. So there are literally warehouses of data sitting unexamined, photographs unopened practically, you know, magnetic tape unlistened to from magnetic recordings and all kinds of instrument, you know, detection mechanisms that literally there has been no time or money or talent to analyze.
It's just sitting there.
It's just sitting there because it's glamorous to send a probe where no man has gone before. Does that sound familiar?
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of, you know, the grunt work to year after year after year wade through the data to try to extract the next set of data points to make sense of it. And it has been left to the kind of almost random scientific process where scientist A gets a pet idea and follows it, and his grad students get entrained, and he has a little bit of money, but never enough money to do the computer modeling and to look at a few photographs. I mean, do you know that Viking took, in the entire extended mission, over 100,000 pictures from orbit alone of Mars? That's a staggering number. And it was only in 1985 or 86 that they finally converted, 10 years after Viking, the last of the magnetic data tapes to hard copy photographs at the National Space Science Data Center. That's how far behind they were. And you cannot tell me, because I happen to know for sure, that more than a fraction, more than a percent or two of those photographs ever got the kind of careful analysis that they should have. It turns out that of all the places on Mars that have been analyzed, probably the Cydonia region in the northern Martian desert, because of the independent investigations that I and my colleagues have been running now for 10 years at a minimum, are the most intensively studied of any region on Mars with as many cross-checking techniques as one can bring to bear on modern remote sensing planetary photography and data. Now, that is not my opinion. That is a statement which is going to be on the record from a very classy guy, an eminent epistemologist and historian of science, Professor Stan McDaniel, who is in the process of completing an almost year-long independent review of our work, Pietro Molinar, You know, everyone who's been involved with the so-called Face on Mars problem, the Monuments of Mars, going back to when the photographs were initially taken, including and most specifically the Viking team themselves and NASA's subsequent official ignoring this very important data.
Are any of the former Viking team presently on board with the Mars Observer mission right now?
Funny you should ask. The Old Boy Network being what it is, yes, there are several members of the original Viking team who just happen to be on the new team on the camera. And of course, there is a standard...
Now, the camera was built out here in California,
camera
JPL.
Was built, well, the camera was actually built in California. It was designed in Arizona, but it was built between Arizona State University and a firm right there in Pasadena, Altadena, actually, under the direction of Dr. Michael Malin.
Well, what makes this camera so different than the Viking cameras?
Well, it's 50 times better.
Okay.
You know, it will be able to photograph objects the size of a coffee table on Mars
from an altitude of what?
249 miles.
Okay.
Statute miles. 378 kilometers for you kilometer fans out there. The important break with the past, though, is this. Viking took out of these 100,000 pictures a handful of pictures of this region in the northern deserts we call Cydonia, on which a lot of effort and time and talent and real scientific inquiry, which according to McDaniel stands up to the best scientific inquiry bar none that has ever been done on data such as this, and he is about to publish this conclusion. That analysis basically points us directly at the real possibility tonight that we are about to see photographs of real artifacts on the surface of the planet Mars. Something built by non-humans, built by aliens, and left for us as a kind of a heritage from a long time ago in the history of the solar system. That's the model. That's the theory. If NASA, if your space agency, were willing to be forthcoming and to come clean on this, then with that kind of solid scientific analysis on file, on record, published in the literature, presented as McDaniel has documented over and over and over again to NASA, as listeners of this program know, I myself have been invited 5 times around the country to present our team's findings to NASA from sea to shining sea, some centers more than once. At the end of all that, what McDaniel has concluded is that it is incumbent upon NASA as a scientific and ethical obligation to take new pictures during this mission of Cydonia and to immediately publish them and resolve this scientific question, which is perhaps the most important question of all time, is going to do, not if they can help it.
Okay, let's talk about that. Let's talk about the arm twisting that the Mars mission people, which you, of course, this is your organization, the arm twisting that you folks had to go through Congress, to get NASA to even agree that they may look at this. And what would their reticence be? I mean, why would they be so reticent to answer a question that would be fundamentally fascinating, if not all important to the entire human species?
These are very important questions, Don. And, you know, we could sit and speculate, as we have done, you and I, both on and off the air, over and over and over again, why is an agency that was created in 1958 by an act of Congress to be unquestionably the most open, above-board, freewheeling, you know, scientific and publicly accessible government agency in the history of this republic, why would it act weird and squirrely and crazy and contradictory and very unscientific on this particular subject? Why would it again and again and again mount ad hominem attacks against investigators like DiPietro, Molinar, myself, Carlotto, Torin, Pozos, you know, everyone? Why would it simply not say, you know, you guys have assembled some kind of interesting stuff here. We didn't have the time to do it, but you've done the work. When we get there with this mission, we'll take new pictures. Instead, What we have found going back several years now, since I met with Chairman Rowe in the company of Errol Torin and Mark Carlotto.
Now this, of course, Chairman is Rowe, Congressman.
The former chairman of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology.
The congressman from New Jersey.
Congressman from New Jersey, who basically, after he saw our data circa 1989, was impressed enough by the robust and compelling nature to turn around to Lynn Henninger over at NASA and basically say, take the damn pictures. And there were a series of memos and letters exchanged between Rowe's office and NASA headquarters that resulted in his assurances not only to us, but to members of the Mars mission, to members of the general public, to members of the press, everything from USA Today to ABC News, and all other comers, Wall Street Journal included, that in fact NASA had agreed to put Cydonia on the priority list and that new pictures of the face on Mars and the monuments of Mars would be forthcoming during the Mars Observer mission. Then, about a year after doing all this, not only does Rowe suddenly resign as chairman of this committee, but he then leaves the House itself, resigns from the Congress of the United States, and reporters cannot reach him, I cannot reach him, nobody can get to talk to him for some reason. The new chairman has been sending out letters basically reiterating the same things that Rowe was saying, but in fact, if you listen to the principal investigator on the camera, Dr. Malin, whose camera it is that is flying to Mars on the Mars Observer mission, he has said categorically that no one is going to tell him what to take pictures of and what not to take pictures of, and he has said categorically that he cannot waste the taxpayers' money taking pictures of a group of objects that a bunch of crazies think may have meaning, including numerological implications. And it is that extraordinarily unscientific attitude and lack of minimal scientific curiosity that Dr. McDaniel, in his study, has now carefully documented and, in fact, picked apart and refuted point by point by point. But where we left tonight is that we have a contradiction. We have a mission which is about in 3 weeks to arrive in orbit with a camera which can settle the question once and for all. We have a very important question. I mean, the idea that there could have been former life on Mars is a non-trivial supposition. It's a non-trivial proposition.
Well, it doesn't even actually matter if it were indigenous or not.
No, it doesn't.
If it were from outside of the solar system.
Which is our model, that these were visitors, that whoever built this stuff did not originate on Mars. The point is that if, as we were looking at this whole problem before Viking, we find as much as a microbe on Mars, then the implications for life in the galaxy, in the universe, is stupendous. It means that the human race is not alone. It means that the Earth is an abode of life, is not unique. It means that we have friends and neighbors and cousins and all kinds of other fellows out there. And, of course, for those of you who are listening to Don's show, it means that UFOs have to be recast in a completely different light, because if someone could find the solar system once, a long time ago, then someone could certainly find it once again, and maybe whoever did what's on Mars is back to check on what has currently been happening since they went wherever they have gone. That's all the model.
Okay, Dick, we've got to take the half-hour break. When we come back, more with my guest, Richard Hoagland, author of The Monuments of Mars, A City on the Edge of Forever, one of the gentlemen in the Mars mission, and we are talking about NASA and why don't they want to take those pictures on Mars in 3 weeks.
Legends were born surrounding mysterious lights seen in the sky flashing.
And we are back with my guest, Richard Hoagland. We're talking about the Mars Observer, NASA, and what is happening on Mars in the next 3 weeks. And we are back. Okay, Dick, after all those messages and music and everything, we're back on the air. What was one of the major problems that you saw with Malin's overall view? I mean, does this man not realize who in fact it is that he's working for. Has anyone pointed this out to him?
Well, they have tried, and, you know, Dr. Michael Malin is a very interesting person. Mike Malin was an undergraduate and then a graduate student of Dr. Bruce Murray at Caltech. He is a geologist. Dr. Murray is, of course, perhaps best known for being the co-founder, along with Carl Sagan, of the Planetary Society. Bruce Murray is basically, I guess, what you would call an anti-life person in the solar system, and let me explain what I mean by that. Over the years, as we have sent these spacecraft to various planets, there has been an interesting polarization develop in the so-called planetary science community. There are the scientists, represented by Bruce Murray, who think that looking for life, looking for biology, is a big waste of time. That the Earth is overwhelmingly and so obviously the only inhabited planet or habitable planet by anything up to and including people, that it is silly to put instrumentation on spacecraft and pay good money to look for biology in other planets. So he was one of the real critics and detractors of the idea of the biology experiments on the Viking landers to begin with.
Well,
Sagan, on the other hand, has been well known over the years as the proponent of the most audacious and amazing places where biology might be found, proposing at one point that not only would we find life on Mars, ambling past the cameras of the landers, maybe, but that at some point you might even, when you send probes to Jupiter and Saturn and you can actually have cameras on them, you may see huge aerial creatures, life forms, swimming in the clouds in the upper atmospheres of these giant outer planets, warmed gently by the energy and heat that is coming from the insides of these bodies that would maintain a level of terrestrial-like atmospheric conditions several thousand miles in depth. So you have this incredible polarity and dichotomy between two scientists at opposite ends of the spectrum collaborating and creating the Planetary Society and all that it is supposed to be doing. One of these scientists, Bruce Murray, has a grad student named Mike Malin, who, if you know anything of how the academic process works, people tend to kind of, if I may say, gravitate toward the professors for whom they identify philosophically. It's not often that you get a grad student that really thinks opposite his professor. And yet a very curious thing happened in Mike Malin's career. Back in the 1970s, in the late 70s and in the early 80s, Mike Malin got caught up in the Billy Meyer Pleiadian UFO controversy. And when he was at Arizona State University, he was one of the people that the elders and Wendell Stevens came to with photographs ostensibly from a UFO landing case in Switzerland, the famed Billy Meyer case, probably one of the most contentious UFO cases on record. Would you not agree, Don?
Yes.
In vilified. I mean, I have never seen any case, except maybe Roswell, picked apart and lambasted and critiqued and attacked by more people at more ends of the spectrum than the Billy Meyer Pleiadian Switzerland case. Into this maelstrom of intense controversy. I mean, this was not a low-profile case where you could kind of get in, do some good science, and get out. It was the highest profile case possible. It was the most contentious. It produced the most bitter battles. And I won't go through all the stories because you may be quite familiar with them if UFO Tonight has dealt with this before. The bottom line is that in Gary Kinder's book, Light Years,
yes,
Michael Malin is quoted on the record as saying that as an optical specialist, using remote sensing planetary science techniques and technologies, he could not prove that the Billy Meyer photographs were hoaxes. That they had all the attributes of possibly real images.
We've got some phone calls on hold, Dick. Let's take a couple of calls. We have got Mark in Springfield, Virginia on Media General. Good evening, Mark.
Hi, yeah, I don't know if anybody out there's read the book, The Montauk Project, but there's chapter 14. They mention Richard Hoagland here, and they also mention something that could be a clue to why they're keeping it such a secret. something about these time experiments and time portals. They claim to have, I don't know, projected all the way to underneath the Pyramid of Mars there, for what it's worth.
Did you get that?
Yeah, I've read the book. I think it's total, absolute nonsense, and frankly, I think it's part of the disinformation campaign to get real people to ignore the monuments of Mars and the importance of the Mars Observer mission.
Well, Dick, you're with friends. Why don't you just tell us what you really think?
I have told the author this, and in fact, we've had a very, as Kissinger used to say, honest and straightforward discussion. There is so much nonsense in this field, Dom, that frankly, I think we have to begin to draw the line. And we have to reward good scholarship and good thinking and good science, and we have to basically tell it like it is when it is not. And believe me, that book, I think, is not.
Okay, did that pretty much answer your question, Mark?
Well, I guess. I just thought it was food for thought for the folks out there, you know. This could be one of the silly reasons why they're keeping it, you know. They're going back and forth and just kind of wasting our money.
Okay, well, I want to thank you for calling and keep listening.
Okay, thank you.
Uh-huh, bye-bye.
Thank you, Richard. Bye.
All right, we've got Jason in North Hollywood on United Artists. Good evening, Jason.
Hi.
Did you have a question for Dick or myself?
Well, I think probably for Dick. What I wanted to know is I just heard you mention about the Billy Myers controversy, and I wanted to know, what can you tell me is going on with that? I mean, if they're really getting out of hand with grilling with all the Billy Myers stuff, I want to know more about what's going on, because I never hear anything that's going on with the Palladians and Billy Meyer.
Well, my point of bringing that up was that you know, Dr. Malin, as a grad student at the knee of Bruce Murray, who is vehemently and virulently, you know, UFOs are nonsense, there's no life anywhere else in the universe, the Earth is the only place, we shouldn't be wasting science and taxpayers' money on looking for it, in that environment, Mike Malin in the 70s and in the early to mid-80s was courageous enough to step forward into the middle of the most contentious UFO case on record, to look at the photographs and to basically give his scientific imprimatur to the fact that they were not obvious hoaxes, and in fact, they were kind of interesting. He went on record. What is stunning is that in the years since, when he was suddenly tapped on the shoulder and his camera was picked to fly on the Mars Observer mission to go to the one planet where there is now credible evidence assembled painstakingly by us and a number of other people over the last 17 years, he suddenly eschews the idea of aliens, UFOs, ETs, life in the universe, and has claimed to several reporters that he has zero interest in such silliness and he's only interested in the geology of Mars. And my question is simply this: does someone undergo this radical a character transformation, or is that the price of getting in on the inside to use his camera to photograph the monuments of Mars by simply telling us outside that they do not exist and he doesn't care if they exist? The fact is that when the going was tough, he was there on the subject. And now that he's in the catbird seat with a camera which can prove or disprove a very important hypothesis, he claims he is not interested.
Okay, so do you think that once he, let's say he gets a lot of the film then from this mission, that he might suddenly say, okay, yes, now I am really involved and I just said that just so I could get the film and now I can give it to the public type of thing?
Well, look at the following setup that NASA has arranged in terms of his contract. Dr. Malin has a private contract which gives him exclusive control over this data for a period ranging from 6 months to a year. He has been set up at a private optical laboratory in San Diego, hundreds of miles from the nearest planetary scientist. He's not even going to be in Pasadena at JPL. Furthermore, he will be conducting his operations of the camera by remote computer control, and no one will be looking over his shoulder to decide or validate the commands he sends to his camera or to check on the data coming in from the camera. He is going to have exclusive control of the data flow to and from the Mars Observer without public accountability.
Now, he would be a NASA contract He's a NASA contract employee.
NASA contract employee, which means that he is basically being paid by all the rest of us.
Right.
But his contract is a very interesting contract. Now, if you got $400, Don, we can get to see the contract, we were told. We filed an FOIA request, and we were informed gently that his contract is not subject to FOIA because he is a private contractor.
Very interesting.
So
okay.
We can't even see the details.
Jason,
yes.
Thank you for your call.
Thank you very much.
Okay, we're going to go...
Let me finish one point, all right?
Yes.
The point is this. If Dr. Malin really has been taking our data more seriously than he has been, you know, giving out that he has, he is in a beautiful position to quietly take pictures, to put them together as books, videos, film, whatever, in that six-month period, and suddenly come out and blow all of the independent investigators out of the water, because obviously in the marketplace of ideas and in the marketplace of photographs, if he publishes his own book validating the monuments of Mars, then everybody's going to gravitate to Dr. Michael Malin and his perception and his theories as to what he is seeing.
Well, this is certainly, Dick, one of the odd characteristics of this overall case, but something that we did not even address yet is prior to this mission taking off, and as a matter of fact, I just received from JPL a newsletter on the Mars Observer, Are We There Yet? Arriving at Mars on August 24th, etc. But a year ago, when this mission was originally geared to take off, it was delayed. We ran into problems with Hurricane Andrew, and the capsule was secured, hopefully, so it would not be damaged by that terrible storm that hit Florida last year, lest we forget. And then the mission was to take off about the 16th of September, and it turned out that there were some problems with it. This is one of the things that we discussed the last time you were on the program.
Yeah, there was mysterious contamination of the camera by debris that somehow had gotten into the sealed nose cone, which was protecting the spacecraft on top of the Titan rocket sitting in, at the pad at the Cape in Florida. And it took them 2 or 3 weeks to take the spacecraft off the rocket, back to the clean room, and take it apart and literally dust it, clean it from the debris, which somehow had contaminated it.
And by the way this capsule was protected, it would have been virtually impossible that those contaminants would have been from the storm. Is that correct?
Well, there's no way they could have gotten in there from the storm. And when they did a review, as they do, they set up teams to basically analyze problems. The team's conclusion was that they could find no local source of the contamination in terms of the chemistry, the particle sizes. I mean, there was everything from lint to paper to glass to iron filings to paint chips. It looked like someone had swept up the floor, Don, and dumped it on this spacecraft.
So what we're looking at is very possibly someone did not want that capsule. And, I mean, it's not too much of a stretch to think that there could have been some type of sabotage. In a zero-G environment, this stuff would have been floating all throughout that capsule, and there would have been terrible problems.
Well, at the very least, what it would have done is to stick to the lenses of the camera, in which case it's very hard to see through crud.
Okay, let's go to Jonathan in Fullerton on Comcast. Good evening, Jonathan. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay, do you have a question for my guest?
Yes, I do. Why is it not that they cannot use the Hubble telescope to take pictures also?
Don, now don't laugh that way. All right. Yes, that
it's
knowing
funny
laugh.
Should,
is,
funny, funny you should mention
is,
that,
is not. It's not the shadow, that is Don Ecker.
I mean, they're getting out there to retrofit it with new lenses, per se, and I'm sure at one point or another the Hubble is pointing in that direction.
Well, you know, you got some basic physics to think about here. The Hubble Space Telescope is basically Mount Wilson in orbit. All right? The Mount Wilson Telescope, which is a few miles away from where Don Ecker is sitting this Sunday evening, or Monday morning, I guess it is, up on Mount Wilson is a 100-inch mirror that was built roughly 70, 80 years ago at the turn of the century, just after the turn of the century. And its counterpart in orbit has a 95-inch mirror. Now, because of the laws of optics, the smallest thing you can see in space is basically determined by the size of your biggest mirror. You can't magnify beyond a certain point because of the limited nature of the wavelength of light itself. Follow me?
Mm-hmm.
So, under ideal circumstances, if there had never been anything wrong with Hubble, there still is a physical limit to the size of an object you can see X number of miles away.
Mm-hmm.
On the moon, it turns out we can see pretty tiny things, even from Earth orbit. All right? And let me tell you roughly how small a thing you can see. You can see something about 100 feet across. All right? Now, that's compared to a mile for terrestrial telescopes. In other words, if there was a McDonald's on the moon, with Hubble, you could see it.
God forbid.
Okay. Now, Mars is not 250,000 miles away, a quarter of a million miles away like the moon. Mars, at its closest point, is 35 million miles away. And it's rarely at its closest point, right?
Mm-hmm.
So its average distance is more like 50 million miles, all right?
Okay.
So let's do the math. How many times does a quarter of a million go into 50 million? Four times, right? So it's 4 times 50,
no,
which
it's
is
four,
what?
4 times into a million, Dick.
Yeah, yeah. So then you multiply by 50.
Right.
So
it's 200 times.
200 times. So the Mars is 200 times farther away, which means the smallest thing the Hubble can see on the on Mars would be 200 times 100 feet. So how small is that?
Oh, my human calculator over there responded.
200 times 100.
Okay.
Oh, I've already done all the work I'm going to do tonight.
That's why you were laughing.
All right, well, 10 times, all right, 100 times 100 feet would be 10,000 feet, right?
Well, listen.
10 times would be 1,000 feet. 100 times would be 10,000 feet. 200 times would be 20,000 feet. That's about 5 miles, right?
Okay.
So the smallest thing the Hubble can see on Mars at its average distance is 5 miles across. Gentlemen, the face is only 1 mile across. Hubble cannot see the face.
Hmm.
So Hubble is not part of the equation.
Okay. Now, how do I keep...
That, by the way, is not why the Hubble cannot see straight.
Okay.
They did not do something to Hubble to keep us from seeing the monuments of Mars. The numbers tell the tale.
Okay. Now, how do I go about keeping in touch as time goes on with this conversation? For example, there are many private bulletin boards out there that keep you up to date with what's happening. You know, as such a source.
Well, one thing, Jonathan, of course, would be. But yeah, there are numerous and myriad bulletin boards all over that carry various echoes, science echoes, NASA updates. You know, one that immediately comes to mind, which is a national computer informational database, is ParaNet. It's just a matter of finding a computer node that carries all that.
Mm-hmm. We are considering, because of the progress we're making on the political front and in getting NASA to change this policy of no live television, and there is an up, you know, set of developments that we're going to continue as we get further into the evening to describe. We are considering some kind of instant alert so people can call in to an 800 number, a 900 number, or electronic bulletin board and get updates. And of course, the Mars mission furnishes a bulletin or a journal 4 times a year, but that's going to be pretty slow compared to the rate at which things are going to happen. Because what we have to remember, gentlemen, is that August 24th is not when the fun begins. That's merely when the spacecraft is braked by onboard rockets and is put into a 3-day orbit around Mars. It is going to be several months before that orbit is evolved and changed and maneuvered into the final mapping orbit, circular at 249 statute miles above the Martian surface. We now have, from both exterior and interior to NASA sources, a date for when the rough mapping orbit will be achieved, which is October 28th, and a date when the final mapping orbit will be achieved, which is now intended to be November 8th. And so on November 8th is when it is possible for the actual photography of Mars, including Cydonia, to begin, and it is that time where things are going to get very interesting.
Will it not be shooting pictures on the way into its first orbit?
They took pictures, as a matter of fact, early part of last week, they took a series of pictures over a period of about 48 hours. And you see, this camera is not like a normal camera where you open the shutter and you snap a picture and there's a frame. It is a line of diodes, and the physical motion of the spacecraft has to scan the X-axis or the Y-axis like a fax image, all right?
Like a hand scanner.
Exactly. It really is like a hand scanner, all right? So they had to actually pitch the spacecraft as it's approaching Mars in the Y-coordinate to scan, like a hand scanner, very good, down across the image of the planet. And what they did was they did several scans over a 48-hour period, and they're in the process of assembling a color motion picture of the rotation of Mars in front of a spacecraft as we approach from a distance of about 4 million miles, which should be pretty stunning. And I would imagine that that will be done by computer. And when they hold the press conference after the Mars orbit insertion on the 24th, which NASA has informed us they intend to hold, I imagine that will be one of the TV products that were released to the networks and CNN to be shown all over the world.
Okay, guys, we are going to have to take a break. We're running a little behind on ad times. Dick, stand by. We'll be back in just a few minutes. We're probably going to go right from the ad into the half-hour break, and we'll be right back.